14, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, and we caught the bloody British in a town in New Orleans. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. We looked down a river and we see the British come, and there must have been 100 of them beating on the drum. They stepped so high and they made the bugles ring. We stood beside our cotton bales and didn't say a thing. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run him on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Old Hickory said we could take them by surprise if we didn't fire muskets till we looked them in the eye. We held our fire till we seen their faces well. Then we opened up our squirrel guns and really gave them well. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, they ran through the briars and they ran through the brambles, and they ran through the bushes where a rabbit couldn't go. They ran so fast that the hounds couldn't catch them on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. We fired our cannon till the barrel melted down, so we grabbed an alligator and we fought another round. We filled his head with cannonballs and powdered his behind, and when we touched the powder off, the gator lost his mind. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, they ran through the briars and they ran through the brambles, and they ran through the bushes where a rabbit couldn't go. They ran so fast that the hounds couldn't catch them on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
All right, good evening, everybody. It is Tuesday, May the 7th, 2024. It's 8:13 in the p.m. Toronto time. And this is the Fakeologist Show. We've got Lynn Ertel here tonight because Tuesday night is the Lynn Ertel Show night. So how you doing, Lynn? How you doing, Lynn?
Pretty good.
Okay. Step up to the mic if you don't mind.
Yeah, I'm the mic here.
Put the mic right in your face.
All right. How's that? Can you hear
that's
it now?
Much better. Much better. You got the snowball going on. We're on FakoTube. We're also on YouTube. We're also on DLive and Twitter and Odyssey. Now, I unfortunately forgot to delete the Jim Rizzoli show off YouTube right after I said that only authorized people can be on YouTube. And I forgot to delete that show before I went to sleep. And in the morning, my YouTube channel was canceled or suspended, strike one. So we're on the backup YouTube channel. So this is how it works. We have three YouTube channels. The first one, and I couldn't remember how I numbered them. The first one is my permanent YouTube channel that I do not stream to. So that's shortfake.com/YouTube. The two streaming YouTube channels, and bookmark these, please. shortfake.com/YouTube2, the number two. And shortfake.com/YouTube3. The number three. So we have three YouTube channels. The number two and number three are the streaming channels. And then I delete the content right away. That's how it works. So if you want, if you're in, it seemed like everyone, because we had a good run because I was very responsible with one of the YouTube channels, but unfortunately I fell down and I got suspended for a week. So those notifications didn't go out. Because you're not going to get them because the channel's not streaming, but the other YouTube channel is streaming. Of course, we have FakoTube, FakoTube.com. That's where we prefer to stream because it's our own platform. And so far, we don't get banned from our own platform, which is fantastic. So I see a couple people are over there on the FakoTube right now. And the FakoTube has a chat. So please say hi in the chat to let me know you're there. I see Kate Emma, an unknown user, who is an unknown user. I don't actually know who that is. So it says unknown user. I'm not sure why. Maybe that's their actual name. Anyway, so we're going to continue the cult, the cult series that Lynn started on last week. Fantastic series. Everyone loved it. Well, at least I liked it. I think we got a couple positive comments. I think I sent one to you, Lynn. I think I bounced an email to you. And let me see if I can find it here. Do you remember that one? You got a positive review. Somebody loved it. Are you there? Let's see here.
Last week.
Last week's show.
Yes. Seems like a long time ago.
Let me see here. Somebody said something. Hold on. Okay. Okay. Would you want a negative review?
Yeah, go ahead. I mean, I don't, whatever.
Okay, this is from Nancy. It says, "Hello, fakeologist. You had your hands full with Lynn today." This is from April 17th, okay?
So, forget that.
Forget
that's
it?
That's from almost a month ago. Okay. I don't know. I read it. Yeah, I probably saw it, yeah.
No, I think it was just to me.
Oh, okay.
But well, I won't read it.
Might have copied me on it. You might have copied me on it. I don't know. Was it about Flat Earth?
No, it's just about you were getting mad at people. Maybe you're having a technical day. Yeah, you're having a technical thing.
Right.
Here's a message from Aaron. No, I don't know who it's for. Let me just play it real quick.
Hello, I was listening. This is Aaron, E-Angel. And of course, my favorite, Jan Eric, was on. You guys talking about Jehovah's Witnesses, and I'm just as a nurse anesthetist, when they don't want blood transfusions, it's kind of hypocritical because then I have to give them other factors and drugs to keep them alive during heart surgery. So it's just kind of weird. Like, they won't accept blood, but they'll take all these drugs. Anyway, that's all I'm saying. Bye bye.
Yeah, she's a nurse, and she's just saying the Jehovah's, they won't accept a transfusion. But they need chemicals to keep themselves alive if they don't get the transfusion.
Yeah, they're full of... I've had many, many discussions with people from the Watchtower Bible.
Right.
They have their own translation of the Bible, which is highly questionable. And I don't want to get into all their doctrines, but they've always been a cult. And in particular, they're a millennialist. They're a doomsday cult. And the last time some of them stopped off here in my living room, we talked for about an hour, and they're more doomsday oriented than ever. So they haven't changed much. But I'm not surprised that they would be hypocritical about not taking a transfusion. That's their interpretation of a particular passage in Leviticus. That is the origin of what we call the what Sigmund Freud called the blood taboo in Judaism and in many ancient religions. Now, if you're familiar with Jewish dietary law, and also with respect to menstruation and the mikveh is the ritual bath. Jewish men, Orthodox Jewish men, are not allowed to sleep with their wives when they're menstruating, and the women are considered unclean. And this is because Judaism, like many ancient religions, has an irrational repulsion and fear of blood. And consequently, if you dine with an Orthodox Jewish family and they have any kind of beef, like brisket, it will be super, super salty. Because that's how they get rid of all the blood. An egg that has a single blood spot on it gets thrown out because it's not kosher. So what this all springs from is a passage in the book of Leviticus. It says, well, there's plenty of stuff in there. There's all kinds of rules about, you know, but with respect to the Jehovah's Witnesses, they interpret all of these laws about not consuming blood in the Old Testament, they interpret that as a prohibition on a blood transfusion. But Jews do not. Jews, they love transfusions, right? Maybe Jewish doctors might have started doing it and made it a fad. So,
okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so the Jehovah's Witnesses have absolutely no real basis for interpreting that particular passage that particular way. But there's so much in the Torah that is, I think, interpreted in a ridiculous way. There's a passage that says, "Thou shalt not cook a kid in the milk of its mother."
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know. Maybe there was a practice among the ancients to take a baby goat and cook it in the milk of its mother. Maybe that's what they're referring to. But Orthodox Jews extrapolate from that to the idea that you can't have a cheeseburger. And they designate certain foods are considered meat and certain foods are considered non-meat or dairy. And you can't mix them together. So you can't have a chicken and cheese. You can't have a cheeseburger. But you can have cheese with fish, like a bagel and lox with cream cheese. So
what about a chicken with cheese?
No. Oh, no. And that's the crazy thing. Okay. Eggs can be consumed together with dairy, milk, cheese, whatever.
Right.
But chicken cannot, because chicken is classified as a meat, like beef, which is crazy. Right? You can eat eggs with your cheese, but not chicken. That's stupid, you know.
It is nuts.
It's nuts. But, you know, I'm not out to offend any Orthodox Jews out there to keep kosher, but it doesn't make any sense. It really doesn't. Maybe it did at one time. Maybe there were hygienic reasons. Certainly, we can see lots of reasons not to consume pork. Mm-hmm. It's very problematic. Have you ever seen what pigs eat? I mean, they will eat plastic.
They'll eat anything. They'll eat people.
Right. But also, the Jewish dietary prohibition of shellfish. Can you imagine that, living here in Maryland and not being able to eat a crab cake or shrimp? Living in Louisiana and not being able to eat shrimp because they're not kosher? Jewish diet's so limited, really. It's like, it's just not that good. It really isn't. I much prefer the Greeks, the Italians, the Arabs, you know. I think halal, which is the Islamic version of dietary laws, is a lot more sensible. It's a lot more sensible. It is. It's a little more reasonable. Basically, it just prohibits pork and alcohol and a few other things, but it's not as extreme as the Jewish kashrut, which is really ridiculous. Anyway, how do we get into that? Oh, because you were reading a letter. But
I don't know how we got into it.
She was talking about the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Oh, yeah, the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, who pretend to be experts on how to interpret the law and to live by the law and so forth. And, of course, they do celebrate their Sabbath on the seventh day as God commanded, which is Saturday.
Austin says Saturn Day. Yeah.
Well, that's because the pagans, you know, associated with Saturn. But whether they also have Sunday services, which is the Lord's Day, I don't know whether the Jehovah's Witnesses also have Sunday services, but, and I think the Seventh-day Adventists also observe the Sabbath the same way the ancient Jews did on Saturday. So,
yeah, I know they're busy around Toronto, the Seventh-day Adventists, a lot of traffic around the industrial units that they took over on Saturdays.
So I don't like spending too much time on these obscure religious practices. Let's get back to Andrew Jackson here and the Battle of New Orleans.
Yeah. At the beginning, you're talking about Jan Eric talking about.
I think Jan Eric's really nailed it. He really nailed it to the cross.
And that was on the audio chat. Should we play that? It's where is it here?
Yeah.
It's the Jews, Nats, the war corporations. That's Adam Curry talking about on my FACO tube here. That's Adam Curry talking about who funds AIPAC. If he did the 501c3 on the acronym that funds AIPAC, and it turns, we already talked about that.
It's Lockheed Martin, basically, right?
Yeah, all the defense contractors. They're the Jews. So,
right, and I think Jan Eric's a little easy on. Well, go ahead. Play
a bit of it. Hopefully, it won't buffer too bad. I'm pretty sure you can hear.
Throw it up. The Jews are the managerial class for the owners.
Now, this is on
the bank accounts, front of the stage. It's the simple.
Yeah, you know what? It's not going to play right.
Handy.
Let me just download it real quick so I can play it. Sorry about that. I have to download it off my own website here. So let's do that. And then we'll play it off the audio chat. Look, it already downloaded. Wow, that's fast. That is fast. Fast downloads off FakoTube.
For the owners. They're playing front. Front of the stage. It's simple.
How do you know that? That thing you just said.
So this is Jan Erik talking to John LeBon. John LeBon always likes to get primary evidence, as you know. So
I can give John LeBon all the evidence he needs. I could give him years of evidence on this, but go ahead.
So yeah, that's what Jan Erik was saying. So
because I've done my fucking research, that's why, John.
Like, where'd you get the information?
I was some research. You should try it.
Can you give an example of where you got the information from?
I'm glad you're right asking this question, John. I really am. That's good. Yeah, please.
There are plenty of sources.
I know.
Can you give me one?
You could try searching the fucking internet. It's easy.
I'm asking you, though. Because you're the one saying this. I'm just asking you.
The Jews were living inside the fucking cities of the merchant nobility. It's easy. They were not living outside the city walls of these cities. It's easy.
When was this?
Recently. Up until the early 1800s. Then it changed.
Okay, how do we know that? Like, is that in a book or something? Can I read it like in a book? Is that where that's from?
No, I know. So it was this way in Norway as well. It was in the constitution of Norway that you couldn't have Jews in Norway, but the merchant cities in Norway, the Jews were allowed because it's not considered Norwegian territory, so the Norwegian constitution didn't apply there.
Let me interrupt. Can I interrupt this a second?
Absolutely. The list, merchant cities he's talking about.
Yeah, here's where I really get annoyed by John LeBon.
Oh, good.
You
go
want a source that's footnoted? Max I. DeMont, Jews, God, and History. That's a good source. You want a source? Okay. Edward Gibbon, 6 volumes, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. That's a good source. He footnotes everything. Do you know how many Jewish historical texts there are that confirm exactly what Jan Erik is saying? They boast about it, that they are the intermediaries and the middlemen between the nobility and the peasants. And part of this is because in medieval Europe, Jews were not allowed to own land. And they also were excluded from most of the medieval guilds. So Jewish goldsmiths had their own medieval guilds. And Jewish merchants had their own medieval organizations. And these were recognized as such. Now, what Jan is referring to is the free cities of medieval Europe. Remember, it was this patchwork of duchies and principalities and kingdoms that really couldn't hold things together. But you had what were called free cities, like Danzig, for example. Today it's called Gdansk.
Okay.
Was a free city. In Germany, you had something called the Hanseatic League.
Oh, I've got that here. I did a search for merchant cities and that came up.
Right. It'll come up right away. So the Jews were a part of this, but also the Venetian, the merchants of Venice and Genoa and Milan were also had their own societies. And of course, there were the Medici in Florence, who were merchant bankers. That's how they got their start, merchant bankers. And they ended up becoming popes and kings and queens and everything else. So yeah, the Jews fit into this environment, but it goes back even further than that. Because if you really want to understand the role of the Jews, the Yehuda, the cult of Yehuda, Yehudim, in Europe especially, but actually in the Middle East especially too, you have to look at the clash of empires. Because the Jews as a people, their best skill was to be able to navigate between empires and in a sense to take advantage of imperial conflict and to cut their own deals. And if you consider the fact that after the destruction of the first temple, when Yehuda was carried off into exile in Babylon. And then after 70 years, allegedly, they came back to Eretz Yisrael and they rebuilt the temple under Ezra and Nehemiah, supposedly. I don't know if any of that's true. But we have to remember that the Jews were very well established in Persia, in Babylon, under the Persian Empire, beginning with Koresh, who David Koresh called himself after.
Oh, right.
Yeah, Koresh is the Messiah. People talk about the Messiah in the book of Prophets. It's King Cyrus, Cyrus the Great. He conquered, he created a unified army between the Medes and the Persians and other tribes. He conquered the Babylonian Empire. And then he told all these peoples who had been conquered, you can go back to your homes and rebuild your, you can rebuild your temples and your religions. And he especially favored the Jews. And the Jews became very, very influential, wealthy, powerful in the Persian Empire. They became top advisors and counselors and bankers and doctors, physicians to the great king of Persia. This is the greatest monarch on earth at the time. The only ones who could stand up against the Persia was, of course, the Greek city-states. So when Rome arose as a power in the Mediterranean, in the east, the greatest competition that the Romans had was the Persian Empire, then became called Parthia. And there was constant conflict there, back and forth, and dispute over territory in places like Armenia, which was an independent kingdom that first was maybe sponsored by the Romans, and then it went over to the Persians. Well, the Jews were always, their loyalty in the Roman Empire was always going to be suspect. Because remember, the Talmud is called, well, there were two Talmuds. There's a Jerusalem Talmud, but the real Talmud is the Babylonian Talmud. So in a way, you could say the Jews became an extension of the Babylonian priesthood. That's highly speculative. But now there were Jewish families in Egypt, such as the Alexanders, who were the Rothschilds of their day, who were Roman citizens. Tiberius Alexander, who became a Roman general, he was probably the one who ordered the destruction of the Second Temple. So it's not all, you know, obviously, you can't, how do I put this? There were these contending forces, and it involved elites and intrigues by the elites. Ultimately, the Roman aristocracy, and in particular, the Julio-Claudians, they married the Herodians, who had been the kings of Judea. And in particular, Titus, the son of Vespasian, who became emperor. I think he had Berenice, who was of Maccabean Herodian descent. I don't know if he actually married her, but I think she was his mistress. But there was a very close relationship between Roman elites and Jewish elites, especially the Jewish elites headquartered in Egypt. But remember, there was a somewhat larger, well, a significant Jewish population in the Persian Empire. And in order for the Jews, every time the Jews rebelled against Rome, obviously, which other superpower would they seek out to help them?
Go ahead.
Well, you tell me.
The Persian?
Yeah, how about that?
Oh, I got one. Ding, ding, ding.
Right. So, of course, you know, do you have traitors in your empire? Potentially. There's a great example of how the Jews operate in this respect.
Were they called the Jews back then?
No, they were, well,
the Judeans.
The region was called Judea, but remember, there were also the Samaritans in the north. They practice a different form of Judaism. Right?
Isn't it amazing? I'm looking at the map here. Can you see the map?
Yeah.
It seems like the whole world was right here.
Mediterranean. It was a Mediterranean world. Absolutely.
That was the whole world. And right. And today they've got all the oil. So it's amazing that the whole world today is based on oil. It's not gold. It's based on oil, the most important resource in the world. And it's all here in, I guess this is Babylon, Iraq. And it's all down here, allegedly, in Saudi. So in this one map, this is the most important part of the whole world, really, even today. Like, this part of the world is dictating everything going on today, it seems. It's amazing.
Apparently. The Roman,
they got all the resources. Like, they got the most important resource in the world, oil.
That map you're looking at right there in the ancient world.
Well, this is just today, actually.
Okay, but the Mediterranean was called Mare Nostrum, which means our sea.
This is
because the Romans eradicated piracy from the entire Mediterranean.
Oh, wow.
For about a couple centuries, and trade boomed. They minted coinage. The Pax Romana was essentially, you could hop a boat from Alexandria, Egypt to Spain, and carry your goods. And the only thing you had to worry about were storms. You didn't have to worry about pirates. And Rome built roads. They built roads everywhere in this empire. Mm-hmm. So they created the prosperity and the trade. They built aqueducts and sewer systems and amphitheaters, stadiums, all over the empire. It was a generic culture. And the lingua franca, which is to say the most commonly spoken language, was Greek.
In the Roman Empire.
Yes. Mm. Yes. Latin was still the language of law, the law courts, administration, military organization. And there was Latin literature and Latin poetry, but as the Emperor Claudius observed, we are really a Greco-Latin empire. We're half Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And Greek was the lingua franca. Now, as you move toward the east to Palestine, mm-hmm. and then into even further east into Syria and what becomes the Persian Empire, there they speak Aramaic. And the common people, the Amha-Arets, the peasants of ancient Palestine in the countryside, spoke Aramaic. And ordinary Jews in the city of Jerusalem spoke Aramaic. In order to do business, you had to learn Greek, right? It was something like, think about Spanish-speaking immigrants coming here and learning to speak English. They learn it pretty quick, out of necessity. And so, if you lived in the ancient Roman world and your native language was Aramaic, you probably learned some Greek, enough Greek to get by. If you were going to be a really educated person, then you had to know Greek, of course. Latin, not so much. You only really needed to know Latin. Maybe you wanted to become a Roman citizen and become a lawyer and argue cases in Roman courts. You had to know Latin for that. But Greek was the lingua franca. Mm-hmm. So there's a one particular incident that really sums up the role of Jews when it comes to clashing empires. Because it's not just Rome and Persia we're talking about here. Consider the Arabic conquest of Spain, where the very large Jewish community in Spain was accused of actually betraying the Visigothic kingdoms and opening the gates of the cities to these Arab conquerors in the 8th century.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they were suspect after the Reconquista, when the Christians came back and reconquered the country. There was a substantial Jewish nobility, Sephardic Jewish nobility, and over time they ultimately had to be crushed because they were very powerful and because they couldn't be trusted.
Wow.
And when you consider, for example, the contention between Christian Europe, led by the Habsburgs, the Holy Roman Empire, and Ottoman Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, which is really the most powerful empire in Europe, where the Jews held a very, very favorable position in the Ottoman Empire. In fact, when they were expelled from Spain, the very day that Columbus left in 1492, many of them went to North Africa and to Ottoman Turkey, to the Ottoman Empire, which was all Islamic, because Jews were very, very well treated in the Islamic world. It's a whole story of how the Jews were allied with Muhammad in the reconquest of Jerusalem, with Muhammad's successors in the reconquest of Jerusalem. But the Jews always tended to be more favorable toward Muslims because they were treated better in the Islamic world. They got a rough time of it in Christian Europe for a whole, you know, for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. But just to give you an example, Jews who sort of traveled between the Ottoman Empire and Venice, which is in Italy, actually, they negotiated a secret deal with a Borgia Pope, Alexander VI, Rodrigo Borgia. He became Pope in like 1490, about the time of Columbus, 1480-something, 1490-something.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually negotiated a secret agreement where the Jews sabotaged the Turkish fleet at dock. They set fire to it and they torched it. So they would play, and you know, and they rewarded for that. The Borgia popes treated the Jews very well in the city of Rome, gave them all kinds of privileges and everything else. So the game that the Jews would play is, as middlemen, cutting deals with the Ottomans on one hand, and then on the other hand, they turn around and they cut a deal with a Christian king or something like that. That's how they worked it, as middlemen and as surfing the area of the boundaries between empires, speaking multiple languages. Jews always excelled at knowing multiple languages. This is the meaning of that, of the character of Mordecai in the Book of Esther, right? He was able to overhear people plotting to assassinate the king because he understood one of their an exotic language they were speaking. Of course, the Book of Esther is completely fictional. Even the rabbis admitted that, but it reflects the very favorable position that the Jews had in the ancient Persian Empire, which really dominated the world until the rise of Rome. Well, until Alexander the Great. Remember, Alexander the Great conquered the Persian Empire, but he really got along very well with the Jews. Oh, they loved him. If you ever wonder, when you run into Jews, even Orthodox Jews, who bear the name Alexander or Alex, it's not a Jewish name, it's a Greek name. Mm-hmm. It's after Alexander the Great, or Julius. You will run into so many Jews who are named after Julius Caesar, because the Jews also loved Julius Caesar. They got along with him. Pompey hated them. Pompey didn't trust them. Pompey the Great. But Caesar did. Caesar cut deals with the Jews. So it's like this. The way the Jews look at it, we don't care who this conqueror criminal is. If he's good to us, if he's good for the Jews, we love him.
Makes sense. You want to hear more, Jan Eric?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
The Jews are not allowed there.
Yes, same as the Jesuits and monastic orders.
Yeah, I'm going to look into that.
Mm.
Well, it's true for Norway. Does that mean it's true for the rest of Europe? Or
yes.
The Western world?
Globally, yeah.
Because it's true in Norway, it's true of the whole world, is what you're trying to tell me.
It's a global business being emergent. Simple.
No shit.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
Hong Kong and Singapore are set up by the same people. Yes. Frankfurt, where the Jews allegedly.
Wherever communism has sprouted, you will find a Jew.
And communism is invented by the Society of Jesus. They are not Jewish. They invented it and they tried out the model in South America in the late 1700s.
Can I interrupt here?
Go ahead.
Okay. What Jan is referring to there is something called the Redux Unis. And it's actually the reason why the papacy banned Jesuits, abolished them and banned them for about 25, 30 years. This had to do with a dispute over what was to be done, here's the thing. The Jesuits, founded by Ignatius Loyola, who may have had Jewish background, I think he did, I think he had some Jewish blood, they were out to convert the world. They were the counter-reformation against Protestantism. And Spain and Portugal were the dominant world conquerors. They conquered, basically, they occupied Latin America, what is today Latin America. The Portuguese took over in what is today Brazil. Mm-hmm. And the Spanish pretty much got the rest of it, Mexico and all the rest of it. And the question always was, the people that we're conquering here, do we want to enslave them and put them to work in the mines and on plantations? Or do we want to convert them to Christianity? You can't really do both, can you? Mm-hmm. It's got to be one or the other. And the Jesuit doctrine was, we convert everybody. We go to Japan and we convert people to the gospel. We go to India and they establish missionaries everywhere in Asia and in particular in very remote regions of Latin America. The Jesuits went at great risk to themselves. They did this in North America as well.
They got picked off all over the place.
Yeah, French. Oh, there's a couple great movies. Okay, now I'm going to recommend some movies that I think are pretty good. Okay.
I think I know one. They got the Indians tortured the Jesuit priests.
Well,
I think,
sometimes they did, yeah.
The natives, I mean the natives.
Right, right. The Jesuits were very courageous and very dedicated and achieved astounding success mm-hmm. in converting Los Indios, the Indians, to Christianity everywhere they went. Now,
what are the movies?
Well, in North America, it was mainly French Jesuits. There's Spanish Jesuits too in the Southwest, you know, Arizona, New Mexico, California. But in the area that the French, you know, like where Detroit is a French word for the three rivers, right? There's a three. Is that right? Well,
yeah. Detroit.
Detroit. Right. It's
the three.
Right. That whole region, what became the Louisiana Purchase. Huge region, like twice the size.
I did not know that.
Well, Jefferson purchased it from Napoleon Bonaparte.
Oh, no, I didn't know Detroit. The Detroit.
Detroit is a French word. It's a French word, of course.
No, I didn't think of that. Yeah. That's,
yeah. Coeur d'Alene in Idaho. Well, a lot of these places were discovered by the French and only really colonized by Jesuits. And, wow, the Jesuit mission.
I'm trying to think of what the three rivers are. Is the Detroit River, the St.
Yeah,
the St. Clair River. I wonder
it's
what
a junction of three things. I'm not sure what, but anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. This and of course all this came to a head in something called the French and Indian War, mm-hmm. where as to who was going to decided who was going to dominate the North American colonies, the British or the French, and actually it was a world war called the 7 Years' War. But here in the colonies, it was called the 7 Years' War. And the Indians split down the middle. Certain tribes allied with the French, like the Huron, right. And other tribes allied with the English, like the Mohawk. So, and, you know, the Indians always ended up losing these things one way or another. But the Jesuits, back to the Jesuits. The movie you want to watch is something called Black Robe.
I knew it. Black, that's the one with all the torture.
Right, I think it's in French with subtitles. Yeah, they cut off their ears and they tell seashells and skin them alive, and you know, but it shows you how the Jesuits were out there to convert some of the most warlike Iroquois tribes in North America and places like New York, Canada. Actually, I think Black Robe takes place mostly in Canada, right?
Yeah, but the Huron. The Huron right. Indians, maybe.
The Huron. Now, the other movie you got to watch on this that tells the story of what Jan Erik is talking about here is called The Mission and stars Jeremy Irons and Robert De Niro.
Oh, Bobby D.
And it purports to be a fairly...
1986. Wow.
Yeah, very accurate account of the Jesuit creation of Christian... communes, right? I guess communism is a form of communism, yeah. And they were called reducciones. I'm not sure why they were called that. Reductions. I don't know why they called them that. But they built these huge like native cathedrals, and they taught the natives how to play instruments and how to sing. And all this is reflected in this movie called The Mission that you gotta watch to understand what Jan Erik is talking about, because at a certain point, the governments of Spain and Portugal had to resolve differences over where the boundary line was between the Spanish territories of Latin America and the Portuguese territories. Originally, the Pope had declared a line of demarcation, and there was still some dispute. And that's because the Spanish Jesuits were very much opposed to enslaving the natives because they wanted to convert them to Christianity. They were having marvelous success converting them to Christianity. And when the order came down, sorry, you're going to have to shut down. You just spent like 20, 30, you know, whatever, how many years building up these Christian communities of these Indians who can sing like angels, Christian hymns, and play violins and do all these things. No, we want to enslave them now, so you're going to have to shut all this down. And in the movie The Mission, Jeremy Irons, he plays a missionary, a priest. And Robert De Niro plays an ex-soldier who's sort of doing atonement for his sins. They decide they're going to help the Indians fight back. Of course, it fails completely, and everybody's massacred. But and the Indians run back into the jungle. They escape back into the jungle. But what Jan Erik says about the Jesuit plan to create Christian communes throughout the native population of Brazil is true. As a consequence of many Jesuits, and this would have been at the very beginning of the 18th century, as a consequence of Jesuits, you might say, violating instructions from the Pope and siding with the Indians, the papacy terminated the Jesuit order, shut it down, and prohibited it, I guess, for about 20 years. I forget how many, like, for a while. Quite like 30, 40 years, maybe, for quite a while. Because I guess they felt that the Jesuits were, well, in a sense, the papacy sold out to the slave traders. Because what the powers that be wanted to do in the Spanish and Portuguese empires was enslave these people. And how do you enslave people who you've turned into good Christians? You know, we have the same situation with the Cherokees in Georgia and the Carolinas. The Cherokees early on converted to Christianity, and they spoke English. They pretty much became just like American colonists. They still retained a lot of their traditions. But people wanted that land. The Cherokees had the best land. And so you got the Indian Removal Act, and this was under Andrew Jackson.
All right, we're going to talk about him. Why don't we do that for the last 20 minutes or so?
We'll never cover it because it's a big subject.
Oh, okay.
Right. Andrew Jackson was, well, first, you know, I posted a picture here of George Washington in his Masonic apron.
Okay, let me put that up here.
Right. In case anyone has any doubt that the American.
Oh, yeah, we're going to talk about Masonry. That's what we're supposed to
do. Yeah, well, Andrew Jackson was also a Freemason. And right. In fact, Andrew Jackson is the reason why the first third party in American political history came into existence, called the Anti-Masonic Party, which really was kind of a false flag operation because it turned out its presidential candidate had been a Mason. William Wirtz, his name was. And he claimed that he'd only got to about the first or second degree. But some years later, it was discovered that, in fact, he had actually been a master Mason. And so he lied about it. So we think maybe the Anti-Masonic Party was kind of like a COINTELPRO operation to stop Andrew Jackson from being elected and maybe shift votes over to his opponent, who also was a Freemason, Henry Clay. So it's not real clear on that. This is what would be the election of 1824. That was disputed. It was thrown into the House of Representatives. There was a corrupt bargain negotiated with Henry Clay. And the former Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, who emphatically was not a Mormon, but also was a member of the Anti-Masonic Party. He was their nominee. He became president. So the Anti-Masonic Party It founded in like 1826, 1828, pretty much disappeared by about 1836. It did have a very definite impact. By the way, they were the first ones to have a political convention. A lot of the traditions that we associate with political parties were started by the Anti-Masonic Party. One of their organizers, Millard Fillmore, he did become our 13th president as a Whig, because what happened was when the Anti-Masonic Party kind of dissolved as the Jacksonian era came to an end, they all went over to the Whigs, who were called the National Republicans. And they were basically nationalists, as opposed to the Democratic Republicans, the Democrats, the party of Jefferson. So Andrew Jackson, our first celebrity hero. I know people say George Washington. Yeah, I guess he was our first celebrity hero. But after him, definitely Andrew Jackson, the hero of the Battle of New Orleans, which was more critical than people realize, because if you look at the Mississippi River and you understand the strategic importance of New Orleans.
All right.
Right. Remember that Lincoln, one of the first things he did, because the Union definitely had a better Navy than the South, was he deployed Admiral David Farragut with a fleet to blockade the Gulf Coast, very effectively blockade the Gulf Coast against Southern shipping. And then to occupy the city of New Orleans at the mouth of the Mississippi. And this was really decisive in bottling up the South and preventing it from conducting trade on the Caribbean. And they then had to move over to Texas and basically negotiate, you know, do trade directly with Mexico, which at that time was occupied by French. Well, French troops entered Mexico in 1862 and took it over. And set up Maximilian and Carlotta. Some great movies about that, too. But the idea was the Union occupied New Orleans. Bit by bit, they took over the Mississippi. This is why the Siege of Vicksburg, which was the cornerstone of Grant's strategy for strangling the South, was so critical. Because you had to stop the South from using the Mississippi for transporting supplies to their troops. South didn't have much in the way of railroads, not like the North, and they really depended on the Mississippi. So why do I say this?
Yeah, because keep on the masonry topic. Yeah,
right. During the War of 1812, the British strategy was to capture New Orleans, and Andrew Jackson organized volunteers, many of them from Tennessee and Kentucky and also from Louisiana. And they stopped the British at the Battle of New Orleans. It was considered, actually, the battle took place almost 2 weeks after the peace treaty had already been signed in Europe. That's how long it took for news to cross.
So much to the internet.
Yeah, exactly. So it was a totally unnecessary battle in that sense, but it was also decisive because I think the British had plans to come up the Mississippi and sever the original 13 colonies from this chunk of territory that had been obtained under the Louisiana Purchase. And Jackson's victory at New Orleans stopped them. So anyway, Jackson was a Freemason. Henry Clay was a Freemason. It kind of reminds me of the 2004 election between George W. Bush and John Kerry.
Yeah.
Where both of them, yeah, both of them said, oh yeah, I was in Skull and Bones. Oh yeah, I was in Skull and Bones too at Yale. What a coincidence. Two presidential candidates, both attended Yale and both were a member of this highly exclusive secret society called Skull and Bones, and they laughed about it. Well, that's the kind of situation we were facing in the election of 1824, I guess. Yeah. 1824? Well, the one that Jackson felt was stolen from him was in 1824. It was called the Corrupt Bargain. And Henry Clay couldn't, the election was thrown into the House. Henry Clay couldn't get enough votes. So he negotiated, anybody but Andy Jackson, who was a national hero at the time. And America seemed to have these national heroes, like William Henry Harrison was another one. who became president. Tippecanoe, the Battle of Tippecanoe. They won their famous Indian fighters, right? So we've got the idea is that the American Republic was founded on Masonic principles. That's what people have to understand. That Benjamin Franklin, I think something like 39 signers of the Constitution were Freemasons.
Okay.
So it's not as though that this is any secret. When George Washington laid the cornerstone for the nation's capital, at the ceremony, he wore his Masonic apron. And in point of fact, Washington, D.C. was designed entirely along Masonic lines, as was Paris sometime later.
Okay.
Of course, I guess Bonaparte was also a Freemason. Someone I learned a lot about this from was a graphic designer and artist by the name of Robert Hieronymus here in Baltimore. He published a doctoral thesis on the Masonic design of Washington, D.C., since Pierre L'Enfant, the chief architect, was also a Freemason, and had written and lectured a lot on the Masonic origins of the American Revolution and the Constitution. All these secrets, the Sons of Liberty in Boston, basically were Freemasons. Paul Revere was a Freemason. I think more of our presidents have been Freemasons than have not been Freemasons.
When did they sort of last being admitted Freemasons? When did that die out?
Well, who says it has died out?
Well, they don't advertise it.
Not as much, but I got to think that John F. Kennedy, who was, see, remember, the Catholic Church prohibited its Catholics from being Freemasons and declared it to be a heretical cult. So John F. Kennedy could not have been both a Catholic and a Freemason at the same time. And when you hear that speech he gave about secret societies.
Right. Yeah, that was a good one.
Right. You kind of get, you wonder if that's who he was talking about, see?
Must have been.
I wanted to say something about Jefferson too, Thomas Jefferson, because just to give you a little background here, John Robison, who was a professor at the University of Edinburgh, was the author of a book called Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments of Europe, carried on in the secret meetings of Freemasons, Illuminatis, and Reading Societies. The book was first published in 1797. And appeared in several editions by the end of the next year, including printings in Philadelphia and New York. You know, America, the United States, the new republic was like the world capital of Freemasonry before the French Revolution. We had more Masonic lodges here than anywhere else in the world. But the anti-Masonic party, when it ran, did such public relations damage to Freemasonry that, for example, the number of Masonic lodges in New York State dropped from like 400 to like about 80 something. So for a while there, in the aftermath of the Jacksonian era, it was kind of very unpopular to become a Freemason. Thomas Jefferson exchanged letters with a minister on the question of Adam Weishaupt and the Bavarian Illuminati. And I have posted this in the forum. Oh, boy. Well, you don't want me to go hunt it down in the forum and screen share it? Do you want me to tell you what it...
Yeah, go screen share it if you can.
Let me see if I can screen share it.
We got about 5 more minutes, so we should wrap it up.
Well, let me play something here first.
Okay. What do you got?
I'm going to share this tab.
And thanks to everyone in the chat. We got Lost Spider, Not Shocked, Franny,
Jacques. Begin with you tomorrow morning.
Can you hear this?
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
I'd like to say one thing.
Yes.
Oh, Lord, my God, is there no help for the widow's son? We got to hang on by the strong grip of the lion's paw.
Amen. Thank you, Mr. Castile. Amen. And Mrs. Castile, we will check back in with you and we pray.
You know what that is?
That Masonic?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No help for the widows. That's Masonic code.
Was he wearing a Masonic little badge on his little?
That was a fake active shooter event around a guy named Philando Castile.
Okay, in Minnesota.
I posted the details.
Oh, that's a good one.
In your forum on Integrated Capstone Events. Okay. With that video.
That's good. Hold on.
I saw that.
Like a good one.
Yeah, and that shows that the Masons here, and especially the Prince Hall.
Is that a new shooting or an old one?
That's an old one.
Here it is. I'm showing it now.
Yeah, you want to there's a great detailed analysis of why it was a hoax.
Right here on howmanyknow.com.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Very good.
I've never heard of this site. Let's take a peek at this site, shall we? Wow. How many know? Wisdom, truth, knowledge, understanding. Another fakeologist type site. That's great. Here is the undeniable proof that the Philando Castile shooting was a hoax. So this was posted. Well, this is pretty good. This is what I should be doing on my site.
And of course, there's his uncle saying, oh, no help for the widow's son. He's tipping us off that this was a Masonic ritual.
Wow. How did you find this site?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I remembered. I guess what happened was, you know, I follow these active shooter events when they happen. Yeah. Right away, I run out to BitShooter somewhere to see what's people saying about this.
153 News is pretty fast.
Yeah, 153 News is one. And You Get Tube was another. Brand New Tube was another. And then I started going watching news stories, local news stories about it. And I saw this clip with his uncle saying, no help for the widow's son. And I thought, oh my God, the Masons are in on it.
Oh, that video's gone.
Oh, because what do you mean that video's gone?
No, I'm just looking at Philando Castile full video off this website here.
Oh, yeah, that might be gone. But it might still be out on BitChute.
Yeah, but YouTube's cleaned a lot of them off.
YouTube sucks, man. YouTube is such a bastard.
They clear everything off.
So Thomas Jefferson got involved in this dispute over the Bavarian Illuminati. I've posted a quote from his letter to a minister, an extensive quote. I don't want to read the whole thing, right? Basically, he says the reason why Weishaupt created a secret society is because things were still very repressive in Europe. And Jefferson argues that if Weishaupt were here in the United States, he wouldn't have to have a secret society. He could do this out in the open. Because, you know, let me quote from this a little bit so you can get the flavor of it. Right here. His intention was simply to reinstate natural religion, and by diffusing the light of his morality, teach us to govern ourselves. His precepts are the love of God and love of our neighbor, on and on and on, blah, 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 blah. He believes the Freemasons were originally possessed of the true principles and object of Christianity. That's what he's saying about Weishaupt. The Weishaupt thought that Freemasonry reflected the true principles of Christianity and have still preserved some of them by tradition, but much disfigured. The means he proposes to effect this improvement of human nature are to enlighten men, to correct their morals and inspire them with benevolence, secure of our success, says he, we abstain from violent commotions, to have foreseen the happiness of posterity and to have prepared it by irreproachable means suffices for our felicity, blah, 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 blah. Weishaupt lived under the tyranny of a despot and priests. He knew that caution was necessary, even in spreading information and the principles of pure morality. He proposed, therefore, to lead the Freemasons to adopt this object and to make the objects of their institution the diffusion of science and virtue. On and on and on. And so basically, Thomas Jefferson had a fairly favorable view of Adam Weishaupt and the Bavarian Illuminati. He didn't think they were anything terrible. And you can find that. But there were anti-Illuminist narratives in the election of 1800. Where Jefferson, in a strange kind of way, a sort of reverse conspiracy theory, some people think that this is why Jefferson actually got elected, because the accusations against him of affiliation with Illuminatist ideas actually worked in his favor, because people thought it was unfair. So I wanted to show one other thing here.
All right. Yeah,
Before we leave Jefferson.
Yeah, we got to wrap it up, though. We got about an hour. So.
All right. There's so much about this. I barely scratched the surface, really.
We got a taste.
Just to remind you who Thomas Jefferson was, I want to share this screen here.
Okay. Thanks to everyone listening tonight. Most of you guys are on FacoTube. I think FacoTube's working pretty well tonight. We're on the backup YouTube channel as well.
Here, can you see that?
Okay, share the screen. Okay, here it comes. All right. Yeah, we're looking at it now. Mm-hmm.
Want to tell people what that is?
Scroll down a bit because the thing is blocking it. Something advertises for runaway slave. Oh, Thomas Jefferson advertises for the capture of runaway slave in the September 14th, 1769 edition of the Virginia Gazette. Shoemaker ran away.
Yeah, he has some interesting things to say about this runaway slave.
It's described as being greatly addicted to drink, prone to using profanity, and artful and knavish in his behavior. But he's a good shoemaker.
Right.
Sandy the Shoemaker, a mulatto.
Hey, look, this is just a teaser, because when we get into the discussion of why slavery happened,
right,
here in the United States, it should have died out. It really should have died out by about the time of the War of 1812. Already, it should have been phased out. Why wasn't it? Two very important things. The invention of the cotton gin by Eli Whitney, and the development of the railroad, which made transporting bales of cotton a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is the development of industrial capitalism, and especially the invention of the cotton gin,
freed up a lot of slaves.
Well, it suddenly made cotton profitable to grow in this. Remember, they couldn't really grow tobacco anymore. Tobacco destroys the soil over time. Cotton does too, but tobacco even worse. And originally, slaves worked growing tobacco, except in the West Indies, where they grew sugar on the British-owned sugar plantations. But in the colonies, in the British colonies of North America, it was tobacco. Jefferson grew tobacco. Washington grew tobacco. That was the main cash crop. It's a very, very different kind of crop from cotton. It takes skill. It takes individual attention. You don't use large numbers of slaves to cultivate tobacco. You might use a handful of well-educated, well-trained slaves. Cotton is very different. Cotton, you're creating these huge, massive plantations, and you're really looking for human beasts of burden to pick up. Picking cotton is a miserable. picking fruit is miserable. You know.
Yeah, they're all labor, cotton, super labor intensive. Yeah,
labor intensive. So, the invention and spread of the cotton gin about 1815, 1820, all of a sudden, massive, large slave plantations became profitable.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the Constitution had terminated the slave trade and prohibited it. And the British Empire was moving to shut down the Atlantic slave trade. They were seizing slave ships and hanging the captains of those ships. So the only way to produce new slaves in the South, which was now profitably growing cotton, was to breed them on the plantation. And this is what Northerners had a problem with. See, they knew that there were no slaves being imported anymore from Africa, mm-hmm, but slaves were being bred in great numbers in the South. And I think most Northerners, they didn't like competing with slave labor because they felt it undermined free labor. That's why they were called free soilers. But they didn't necessarily like these blacks. And I think what really disturbed and disgusted many Northerners was the fact if you went down south, running around the plantation, you could see all these little pickaninnies that were half black, half white. And you knew that the slave master and his family were having their way with the slave women.
What were they called, pickaninnies?
I'm using that phrase. Some blacks might find it offensive, but the term for black young black children, that's how Southerners thought about this, see? You know, you don't want people, and especially if you've got a 5 or 6 year old slave, and damn, his facial features don't look just like Thomas Jefferson. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or Edmund Randolph, or one of these rich slave owners. It's pretty embarrassing. Jefferson in Paris, starring Nick Nolte. I think very accurate movie about this.
Where, another movie recommendation. Hold on a sec. Jefferson in Paris.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Very well done. Very well. James Earl Jones, Nick Nolte. Excellently. Everything in there is documented. Everything.
Would a movie like that be made today?
No.
Would it survive?
Well, maybe. I don't know. It might. But the idea was, had it not been for the Industrial Revolution, slavery would have died out in the South because it wouldn't have been profitable. Wouldn't have been economically feasible. It was cotton that made slavery profitable. And all of a sudden, every Southerner wanted to move west, seize new land from the Indians, which is what they did, and start buying slaves and start a cotton plantation. That was how you became rich. It's how Andrew Jackson became rich. From nothing, how he went from nothing to be one of the richest men in the country, sufficient to pay for his own militia. When he went out during the Indian Wars, he hired his own militia. He armed them. He bought their uniforms, their guns. I think he went into debt to do it, but that was how, like Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar financed his own armies. Yeah, that film Jefferson in Paris is excellent in terms of explaining.
Kind of got trashed. 5.7 out of 10, but okay. That's...
Well, the critics can screw themselves on this because I thought it was very well done.
Nick Nolte was Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, I thought he gave it. I thought he made it very. I thought he sounded exactly like Jefferson would have sounded. And the thing is, many of the lines in the movie are taken from Jefferson's own writings. So, you know, it's not like this is just something that was invented. There's real history here. Northerners are really disgusted by the most ordinary common practices of plantation slavery. The fact that slaves were bred because families could be busted up. A husband or a wife could be sent down the river. Children could be separated from their parents. It's a horrible thing. But at the same time, you see all these little slave children running around, and it's pretty clear they got white blood in them. So do you understand why Northerners were so offended by this?
Yeah.
And they didn't want to see expanded into the new way. They knew there was nothing they could do about it in places like Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Virginia, but they didn't want to see it expanded into Kansas or Nebraska or New Mexico, or California. They didn't want to see expanded there. And that's why the Civil War was fought, to keep it from being expanded westward and elsewhere in the hemisphere, because the Knights of the Golden Circle actually wanted to create a whole new empire called a Golden Circle Empire with its geographic center in Havana, Cuba. But that involved the conquest of Mexico. And their plan was to set up cotton plantations all over Mexico and import African slaves. So, you know, Mexico outlawed slavery at their founding when they got independence from Spain. When Americans started settling in Texas, which was part of Mexico, immediately the Mexican law required that they convert to Catholicism and give up their slaves. And the Texans who settled there, in what was part of Mexico at the time, before 1836, they managed to keep their slaves, But like Stephen Austin, for whom the city of Austin is named, he converted to Catholicism. He and all his colonists, when they first came down there, became Catholics to conform to Mexican law and to have first-class citizenship in Mexico, in the Republic of Mexico. But they still managed to keep their slaves. And one of the reasons why the Texans fought the war for independence was to keep their slaves. General Santa Anna had sworn that he would liberate all the slaves because it was against Mexican law. Of course, they lost. Texas became a slave republic. And then probably the intention was all along to bring Texas into the Union as a huge slave state that could then preserve the balance of power for the slave power in the Congress. Right? That's what it was all about. And Ulysses S. Grant writes in detail about this in his memoirs. He says that he considered the war with Mexico in 1846. Remember, Texas got its independence, fought with Mexico, got its independence in 1836. 10 years later, they joined the Union. And the Mexicans said, we're not going to stand by and let this happen. They protested. And the United States basically provoked a war with Mexico. According to Ulysses S. Grant, provoked the war with Mexico because this was the long-term ambitions of the slave power in the South. And Texas was a key to that. But Andrew Jackson played a very important role because remember all the new state he brought in, Tennessee, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, all these new states entered the Union. You know, the Jacksonian period, very dramatic change. You got to consider when he arrived in Washington for his inauguration in 1828, he came by a horse and buggy. When he left Washington after his second term in 1836, he rode home in a steam-powered locomotive. That's how much the United States had changed in just those few years. We now have railroads. We had the cotton gin, all these things. And they made slavery profitable on a grand industrial scale in the South. And that's why we had slavery.
All right. Well, we had quite the history lesson today. I sent an email to Jean-Eric. Maybe he can come on with you next week.
Yeah, I think he's really got it. There are many, many examples in history. The Jews themselves have recorded it. I was going to discuss the role of Jews as rent collectors, the ones sent out by the feudal lords to collect rent from these terribly oppressed peasants. The Lord himself didn't go out to collect the rent. He sent his Jew to collect the rent. And that, in effect, is still the role that they're delegated. So Jan-Erik is absolutely right about that.
You don't think they're the owners? They're still the
Some of them are, actually, some of them are in the ownership class. Like I consider the Rothschilds and the Warburgs to be in the ownership class. Yeah.
Right. But, right.
And also the British royal family is married into to Judaism to the extent that all male heirs to the throne of England are circumcised by a Jewish rabbi. Yeah, I bet you didn't know that King Charles he's got the circumcision mark. So how about that?
I did.
So much for the Church of England. So, right.
Well, I heard they're beholden to the Catholic Church as well.
They seem to have patched things up with the Catholic Church. Yeah, I don't understand.
Well, it's part of the oath.
Yeah.
Queen Elizabeth said the oath. I don't know. I think King Charles said the oath to the Pope. So who knows what's going on there.
Right. We are a Masonic. The United States was founded as a Masonic Republic with slavery. And Masons were on both sides of so many wars and conflicts and revolutions. That's the next thing we got to talk about. How it's the Freemasons who always negotiate the end of these conflicts. Maybe they start them too.
No doubt. All right, Lynn, good talk. Very interesting. A lot of good history. Yeah, sorry we didn't take calls tonight because Lynn was on a roll. And Always good to hear from you, Lynn. And we'll see you next week. We'll see if Jan Eric can come on and talk. Go over these merchant cities of Europe.
Right. Very important in the development of, the development of feudalism into modern capitalism. People say, well, the Jews invented communism. No. Jan Eric's right about that. The Jesuits tried to implement a form of Christian communism per the Book of Acts. Right there in the New Testament.
Yeah.
But if anything, the Jews invented capitalism.
Interesting.
Yeah, wow. As international merchants, they invented global capitalism, for sure. For sure. Not all by themselves. The Italians helped the Venetians and the Florentines and so forth, and the Hanseatic League and trading guilds and so forth. But the Jews played a pivotal role in the evolution of feudalism into capitalism. And the book to read on that is Max Weber's The Protestant Ethic and the Rise of Capitalism. Because Protestantism has a lot to do with this as well. The reason why a place like England industrialized before France, because France was Catholic and England had broken with the Catholic Church and adopted a Protestant ideology, and that's what led to the Industrial Revolution. So why did the Dutch advance so much faster than the French? Because the French expelled all their Protestants or murdered them, the Huguenots, drove them out, and these Huguenots went to Holland and Belgium, and they were the shopkeepers and the tradesmen and the people who created, you know, the shipbuilders. They were the people who created modern capitalism, the Dutch Republic. So Max Weber, The Protestant Ethic and the Rise of Capitalism, gets into that. And the Jews played a really critical role in this as international merchants who, in a sense, had no real loyalty to any empire or nation state, but kind of navigated between these great powers and cut their own deals. And yeah, Jan Eric can explain a lot of that probably.
All right. Thank you, Lynn. Big history lesson tonight. And don't forget, this show is value for value. If you got value from the show, please go to fakeologist.com/donate. Tomorrow will be Fake News Phil. We'll probably be talking about something to do with Gaza. And we'll see where that takes us. All right, Lynn, thanks a lot for coming on. Appreciate it.
Take care.
All right, good night. There goes Lynn Ertel. There goes me. And we'll talk to you next day, which is tomorrow. And don't forget to go to FakeoTube. Most of you found FakeoTube. A few of you are on Twitter. And 4 of you are on the YouTube backup channel. But go to FakeoTube.com. It seemed to work well tonight. Thanks, everyone, for joining in. And we will talk to you tomorrow. Take care.